Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to a special edition of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I'm your host, John Hansen, and this is our one-year anniversary for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We started this podcast on July 5th, 2017, so it is now 1 year of doing the podcast for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. So I want to thank all of you who have listened to the show for the last year or who have just come on and started listening to the show. So as a treat this time, and also for next week, we are going to do a special anniversary show, and we're going to go back, and I'm going to bring back some of my favorite interviews and some of my favorite clips from those interviews for both this week and next week. So we've got about an hour show this week where we're going to cover season one, where we talked about the 40th anniversary of Pumping Iron. And then we're going to go over season two, where we had the Mr. Olympia series, where we talked to a couple of Mr. Olympia winners. And then we're going to go over season three, which was the 1981 Mr. Olympia. So that's what we're going to cover on this edition of our anniversary special. And then next week, we will cover all the other seasons. I tried to fit them all into one show, but it would have been like a 2.5 hour show, and I didn't want to make it that long. So we're going to do part one of our first season anniversary today, and then we'll do part two next week. All right, I do want to mention that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Redcon One. At Redcon One, everyone wants to be a champion. Everybody wants to be their best. And at Redcon One, they believe in working hard to achieve your goals. Whether you're killing it in the gym or running a six-minute mile, Redcon One has something for those willing to put in the work. Their premier clinically dosed pre-workout called Total War is the perfect companion to your workout to give you that extra push to break through your mental and physical barriers. And then you can fuel your body after those workouts with the revolutionary MRE. This is the only whole food complete meal replacement with protein coming from salmon, chicken, beef, and eggs, and the carb sources coming from sweet potatoes and oats, and it also contains 10 grams of fat from MCT oil. This is the best tasting complete meal you will ever have. So go to Redcon One and try the very best that sports nutrition has to offer. Redcon One, the highest state of readiness. And you can enter the discount code LEGENDS, and you'll get a 15% discount off your order when you place your order at Redcon One. And also be sure to check out their MRE bars, which they have many, many flavors over at Redcon One. So check those out when you go there. I also want to thank Old School Labs for sponsoring this episode. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is a supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner, Vintage Burn, the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're the brand that I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe in 2012. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the 2017 Classic Physique Olympia champion and the 2018 Classic Physique Arnold Classic champion. And he's gearing up right now to defend his title at the 2018 Classic Physique Olympia. So we wish Breon the best of luck. I think he's going to do it again. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Benute and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order at oldschoollabs.com. Or you can go to Amazon.com and place your order there. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, we got some good interviews coming up. In addition to our one-year anniversary shows, we've got some good interviews coming up down the pike. I talked to Craig Munson last week. I wanted to talk to Craig because Larry Jackson was talking about him when we did our interview with Larry, where we were talking about old school bodybuilding at the Gold's Gym stage. Craig is a really, really great guy, real nice guy. And he just recently got on Facebook, so I contacted him, and I asked him if he wanted to be on the show, and he said he'd love to. So we're supposed to talk to him next week, so I'm looking forward to that. We're also going to talk to my friend Phil Williams, who was the 1985 NPC Nationals winner. Of course, I did an interview with Phil for our video series on the BodybuildingLegendsShow.com. But Phil wanted to come on in our podcast and talk about his recent award at the Muscle Beach Hall of Fame, and also talk about his days at not only Gold's Gym when he trained there in the 80s, but also I wanted to talk to him about training at George Turner's Gym, which was a famous gym out in St. Louis. Phil trained there when he was a teenager, and he got to train under George Turner, who was a real legend in the sport of bodybuilding. He trained a lot of guys like Ken Waller and Samir. I think Tom Platz trained there for a while. He also trained Tony Pearson. It's going to be great to hear the George Turner stories from Phil Williams. I guess George was a real character. And we should have part two of the John Torelli interview coming up on our video show as well. That'll be coming up probably in another week or so. I'm just finishing up the editing on that. So that'll be a great video to check out. And then after that, we'll have the Lee Labrada interview. That'll be coming up on video. So we got a lot of good stuff coming up on the BodybuildingLegendsShow.com and also the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I also want to mention we're brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services to ensure that you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida at 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, their number is 813-922-8939, or check out their website at flalternativemeds.com. And then mention that you heard their ad at the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and you will get a free consultation. Plus, you'll get 20% off anything you order, which is a great discount. All right, so here we are. We're ready now for our one-year anniversary. Again, I want to thank all our sponsors, Florida Alternative Medicine, Redcon One, and Old School Labs for being there for us for the last year. I couldn't have done the show without you. And I also want to thank all of our fans of the show who email me and send me messages on our YouTube channel, as well as through the website, BodybuildingLegendsShow.com. And I appreciate you guys supporting the show, and I know you really love the show as well as I do. So it's been a great year. We've had a lot of great guests, and I think you're really going to love this one-year anniversary show. So this will be part one, and then we will have part two next week of some of my favorite clips from some of my favorite interviews from the past year. Here we go. All right, we are going to start off our review of our one-year anniversary with season one, which was the 40th anniversary of the movie Pumping Iron, because Pumping Iron was released in January of 1977. So last year when we started the show in 2017, it was the 40th anniversary, if you can believe it. And we started off talking on episode number one of season one. Our guest was Randy Roach. And the reason I had Randy on was because Randy, of course, has written a series of books called Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors. And in volume two, he covered the 1970s. So a big part of his book was about the Pumping Iron movie and the book, and also everything that took place at the 1975 Mr. Olympia contest. So if you've ever read any of Randy's books, Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors, he really goes into a lot of backstage stuff that I didn't even know about. I've been in bodybuilding for 40 years, and I didn't even know a lot of this stuff. So I figured Randy would be a great guest to have on. So in this clip where I'm talking to Randy, Randy's going to talk about George Butler and Charles Gaines and what was the idea behind them first doing the book Pumping Iron and then finally doing the movie Pumping Iron in 1975 and some of the difficulties and obstacles they faced in getting that movie made. Here we go.
So those two contests, the 72 Mr. Universe and the 73 Mr. Olympia, constituted the book Pumping Iron that was published in November of 1974.
So did Charles Gaines and George, well, particularly George Butler, because he was the one behind the movie, but was it because of Arnold, after meeting Arnold in 1972 and then covering him in 1973 for the book, was that the impetus for doing the movie?
Yeah, when they first met him, they thought he had the potential and stuff, but they didn't really think much more of that. But as they got to know Arnold, and with the success of the book has some pretty good coverage, that mm-hmm. George wanted to take it into a movie, where Charles kind of backed away. I think he surrendered the title rights to to George, and Charles narrated it. It was Charles who narrated the movie.
Yeah.
But he didn't take as big a role, and it was mostly George who was going to take all the, like I said in the book, the career haymakers and the chin from doing the movie. He took loans. I think the book came out in 74. By 75, April of 75, he thought he'd do a sample film. He borrowed $30,000 and he went back up to Holyoke, Massachusetts, and did a little sample film with Arnold, and he aired it, in front of a small private audience, and he was just ridiculed, and George said he was close. He told me he was close to tears. His wife just hugged him and said, "I've never felt so bad for somebody in my life."
Right.
So these are two very intelligent, articulate guys putting it all on the line for bodybuilding, and they're taking a beating. They're taking a professional and an emotional beating. Charles, did it bother you that you guys could have gone off and done anything else and been successful?
Right.
He said that he got used to it. He just got used to it, just ignoring it. George had to do that too because he was just running into brick walls, especially the gay stigma to it at that time. Every way they turned, it was the homosexual thing again, right?
Mm-hmm.
George's old lady friend said, "Oh, George, I didn't know you were gay." just because he was doing a movie on bodybuilding, he just automatically makes him gay. It was ridiculous. So he had to, he still plowed on in April of 75. He kept moving on, but at the same time, Bob Raffleson, director, somebody had sent him a copy of Charles Gaines' Stay Hungry novel, and he liked it. And so he wanted to make that into a movie. So they were starting to shoot for Stay Hungry in April 1975, where George Butler was going to start shooting a lot of the same bodybuilders. If you've no doubt seen both movies, correct? So you'll see the same bodybuilders were in both movies. They're trained for Stay Hungry. Ken Waller had a pretty good part in Stay Hungry.
Yeah.
I thought it was funny that only in bodybuilding and in Hollywood, they wanted Arnold to come down to 210 pounds. He was still too big to play a bodybuilder. Crazy, right? A bodybuilder was too big to play a bodybuilder. So Waller looked pretty good in that show. So they just kept training right after Stay Hungry, right into their countdown training for Mr. Olympia. Through the summer of 1975, so they had that overlapping filming and training for those two movies.
Yeah,
but, I was going to mention another thing too. It's kind of funny with the book. Doubleday gave George and Charles the down payment to go do the book, but when they came back with the manuscript, they demanded their money back. That's the walls they're running into. It was Simon and Schuster that came through for the publishing of the book. But
I was going to mention that too, because you were talking about the movie and the problems they were having, but they also had problems with the book.
Yeah.
And then the book ended up being a big success, right, when it was finally released.
Yeah, I think over the years they sold over 800,000 copies.
All right, now we go to episode 2 of season 1, and I had a great opportunity to talk to Roger Callard, who I never had met before. And of course, I had seen Roger growing up in the magazines. I saw him. He was in a lot of Joe Weider's magazines in the 1970s. He was a really good-looking guy, so he was used for a lot of their ads. And he was also a top bodybuilder. Roger was always competing in the IFBB Mr. America in the 1970s. He almost won the show in 1977 when Danny Padilla beat him. And he was in the Mr. International contest. I believe he won his class at the 1976 Mr. International, the same day that Franco won the Olympia. So it was great to talk to Roger. He's got a great personality. And of course, he knew all those guys. He was in the Venice Beach scene in the 1970s. He was a good friend of Arnold Schwarzenegger. So in this scene, Roger really wasn't in the movie Pumping Iron that much because, as he'll explain in this clip, he was out of town for that summer when they were filming the movie. But he was in the football scene where Ken Waller and Robbie Robinson are throwing the football around. And Ken Waller plots to steal the T-shirt from Mike Katz. And in this clip that we're going to listen to now, Roger tells us that it was actually his idea to steal that T-shirt. So here we go.
Well, I was kind of mad because I was in St. Louis that summer.
Yeah.
Working at it. And then I came back, and then they'd already finished filming, and then George and Charles Gaines decided that they needed another scene. So so they put the football thing in there. And Rob, of course, Robbie and I and Waller were the only ones who could play football. So,
yeah, tell us about the T-shirt, because you said that was all your idea, right?
It was my idea because I was rooming with Mike, and I knew he wasn't in shape. And he would all, after we work out, he'd always be looking for his shirt because he wanted to put it on.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when the guys from California, we're running around in tank tops. We're in shape the whole time. We don't give a shit if you're looking at us because we're in shape.
Right.
But when a bodybuilder's not in shape, you're a little vain. You're like a guy with a robe. You might take it off and you want to put it right back on.
Yeah.
Well, that's how he was with that sweatshirt because it was kind of like his security blanket.
Mm-hmm.
And it really kind of hit home in the movie. But, I liked Mike so much because he was such a good family man. And he was just a good guy.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like an underhanded thing. It was more of a funny thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the movie made it look like Waller was a prankster and it was all these things. I mean, Arnold actually hid Sergio's posing trunks on him, so he had to use a different color.
Oh, really?
I mean, guys, we did shit like that, you know?
Yeah, you were rooming with Mike and Stay Hungry, and then you told Waller you should hide his T-shirt when you get out there because he's not really in shape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Waller wasn't the bad guy. It was me. I was the initiator. He was the guy who actually did it.
All right, so now we go to one of my favorite interviews of the whole year, and this was with Charles Gaines. And Charles Gaines, of course, was the author of the book Pumping Iron. And he was also the author of the novel Stay Hungry, which preceded the book Pumping Iron. So Charles and his friend George Butler decided to collaborate and do a book about the sport of bodybuilding. And that's what got the whole thing going. So in this first clip, we're going to hear from Charles. Charles talks about how him and George Butler got together and decided to do the book and then eventually the movie Pumping Iron. And they also talk about meeting Arnold Schwarzenegger for the first time.
And I don't even remember what year this was. It would have been the 70s. And I think it was Arnold's second competition in the U.S. We met him and Franco and Frank Zane and Sergio Nubre, a whole variety of guys. And we went back to our hotel that night, and after covering the competition, George and I did it. First of all, you had to be impressed by Arnold. I mean, a moron would have been impressed by Arnold. But more generally, we were impressed by how much color and life and vitality there was in this preoccupation of bodybuilding and how it had never really been brought to the fore. So we said, you know, why don't we do a book on it instead of just covering a bunch of individual competitions for magazines? I went to my agent at the time, who was one of the best in the world, and it represented me for Stay Hungry. And he said, no, that ain't my cup of tea. No thanks. So then I went to Sandy Richardson, who was the head of Doubleday. Doubleday had published Stay Hungry. And he was the chief there and also a good friend. And I said, Sandy, I want to do this book, and I'm really excited about it, on bodybuilding. And he said, man, look, Stay Hungry was a great success for us. We really believe in you. We want to keep you. But that's, you know, nobody but perverts and weird people are interested in bodybuilding. And he said, right. that book's not going to sell two copies. He said, I hate to tell you, but I can't do it. So we said, all right. So we started going out to California, hanging out with out of Gold's Gym anyway, and taking notes and so forth, because I knew we'd find a market for it. And we got a lot of research under our belt. And I was in Key West visiting a novelist friend of mine named Tom McGuane, and there was a young agent there visiting McGuane from New York, a guy named Bob Dottila. And I was telling him this story about how I'd had such a hard time getting any interest in this book from publishing. And this young agent, cocky young guy from Queens, said, I'll sell it, man. I think it's a great idea. I'll sell it for you. He went back to New York, and 2 weeks later we got a call. He said, I've got an appointment with Dan Green, who was the head of Simon & Schuster at that point. And George and I went in to meet Dan Green and had a meeting with him and laid the whole thing out and said, look, we got to have, back in those days, a pretty good piece of change because we got to travel around a lot to do this, so we need a pretty good advance. And he said, how much do you need? And we named a figure. It was up in the six figures. And he said, "You got it. Go to it, boys." So that was really the origin of the whole thing. And then, of course, the movie Pumping Iron followed the book.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I think you met Arnold in 72, right, at the Mr. America? And I read that you and George...
That would have been at 72, and that would have been just after Stay Hungry was published.
Right.
I'm bad on dates. But when you get as old as I am, you know, the 70s is a long way back there. I can't remember. But it was right in there somewhere in the early 70s, yeah.
I heard that you and George went to breakfast with Arnold the next day, and I think George wrote in his book that he wrote about Arnold, he said that Arnold sort of laid out his master plan for his life, how he was going to conquer bodybuilding and then go into the movies and then eventually go into politics. Do you remember that?
Yeah, absolutely. It was sort of breathtaking, in fact, you know. I mean, we had, for the purposes of the story, to add some sort of journalistic color, I guess you'd call it, we put Arnold and a bunch of the other guys who came from California up at one of the storied literary hotels in New York called the Algonquin.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not at all where that's the home of the famous Round Table with Dorothy Parker and that whole group of great journalists, great New York journalists of the 1940s and 50s. And it, you know, it's one of the toniest, most literary hotels in New York, and not at all where they would have stayed. And the contrast, which is what we were hoping for, and Arnold was the only one really who really got it. You know, I mean, he really got the contrast. And so he said, "Why don't we have breakfast here tomorrow morning?" And we did. George and I met him at the Algonquin. We had breakfast, and he did do exactly that. He laid out this master plan for his life, where he planned to prove himself the best bodybuilder who ever lived, win the Mr. Olympia contest, whatever it was, seven times or mm-hmm. eight or whatever, and go on to, I remember this phrase exactly, marry an American princess, make a ton of money, go into the movie mm-hmm. business, capture that. And then I don't remember his saying that he had aspirations for a political life, but George does, and George has a better memory than I do, so no doubt he was right about that. But it was, as I say, it was breathtaking to hear this guy just off the boat from Austria, you know, with very bad English, wearing, he didn't know how to dress at that point, he didn't know how to do anything, you know, I mean, lycra shorts, and, I mean, he just was a bumpkin, you know, I mean, an Austrian bumpkin laid out in New York. And to hear him lay out step by step the way that he planned to conquer the world was, you know, you had to figure, well, he, you know, he's either got the what it takes to do it or he's certifiably insane.
Right.
and there wasn't any question in mine and George's mind. And this is something that is important about all this because, you know, at that point, Arnold was known by nobody except other bodybuilders. And the bodybuilding industry. I mean, he hadn't done, I think maybe he'd made that horrible little movie called Hercules in New York or something. I don't know whether that had been released or not. But I mean, he had no following. Nobody knew who he was. Mm. And George and I, the minute we met the guy, knew that he was going to be a star. You know, that there was no way to keep this guy from doing whatever he wanted to do. I mean, I've had a very fortunate life. I've traveled all over the world, and I've known all kinds of movie stars and politicians, and I've met lots and lots of charismatic people in my life, but nobody who had the overpowering degree of charisma that Arnold had from the get-go.
That's amazing.
You know, with absolutely no sophistication. And then, of course, when all that got polished over a period mm-hmm. of time, it was even more potent.
Okay, in this clip, Charles talks a little bit more about Arnold Schwarzenegger, about how he would set goals and about Arnold's mind. And it really gives some insight into someone who knew Arnold before he was a success, because Charles Gaines met Arnold back in the early 70s. And this is when really nobody knew about Arnold. So it's really a fascinating discussion where Charles talks about how he could see that Arnold was going to be a star one day.
Well, we would take him to Elaine's in New York, which was at that point the literary hangout for all of New York, Woody Allen, George Plimpton, yeah, everybody, James Baldwin, Norman Mailer, everybody who wrote back in those periods hung out at Elaine's, and a ton of movie stars. We'd take Arnold in there, and he would just sit and watch, and he would soak up behavior and ideas and metaphors and so forth. I've never seen a more absorbent mind than Arnold's. And, of course, when he came here, he wanted to learn, and he had the capacity to do it. I mean, one of the many undervalued aspects of Arnold is he's got a first-rate mind. I mean, not just an okay, adequate mental setup, but a really first-rate mind, and he used that as one of the many tools of his, to build his career, and he used it in, as I say, a very interesting way. I mean, he would soak up things from people and then apply them in ways that he could actualize. So, you know, that listening in the back of the car, that metaphor thing, and then adopting it, making it his own, is just one tiny example of hundreds of things that I've seen him do that are similar.
What also impressed me about Arnold in those early days was not only his charisma, which was evident. I think anybody can testify to that meeting him. I remember I met him in 1977, and I was nervous to meet him because I could just feel the charisma. But
yeah.
Also his confidence. I remember him appearing on The Tonight Show in the late 70s with Johnny Carson, who at the time was a legend, and there was only three stations on back then, and to appear on The Tonight Show was really a big deal. And he was on there so confident and so relaxed, hanging out with all these movie stars and talking to Johnny like he knew him for years. And I was just amazed at this, you know, I think at the time, 30-year-old bodybuilder who nobody knew was able to go on one of the biggest talk shows in the world and just be so relaxed and so confident.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, his confidence was overpowering. And even earlier than that, in 1970, well, right after the book came out, whatever year that was, 75, I think, or something, Arnold and George and I went on the Today Show with Barbara Walters, which at that point,
right.
You know, that was the biggest talk show, daytime talk show in the country, and she was the premier hostess. And I was impressed by that and a little bit nervous about going on the Today Show. Arnold was just like it was nothing. And he went on the show, I'll never forget, he went on the show, and she looked at him and said, "You don't really look all that big." And he said, "Feel this." And did a flex his bicep, stuck it over there, and she felt it, and said, "Oh, yeah, well, I could see." He had it on a jacket, and it was hard to tell, you know. So,
yeah.
But, I mean, he just was playful with her and loose, and he's been that way all of his life, I think. You know, he's never had a doubtful moment in his life.
right.
Most of us, no matter how talented or smart or whatever you are, all of us are plagued with a certain amount of self-doubt and a certain amount of self-consciousness. But Arnold just seemed to have been born without it.
All right, now we move on to season two, which was called our Mr. Olympia series. And we talked to three Mr. Olympia winners, Dorian Yates, Lee Haney, and Chris Dickerson. So in episode number one, we had an interview with Dorian Yates. And Dorian is a great interview because he's very insightful and he's very articulate about what he was going through as he was getting ready to compete and became Mr. Olympia six times. So in this clip, Dorian is going to talk to us about making an impact in his very first pro show, which was the 1990 IFBB Night of the Champions contest. And Dorian talks about his mindset getting ready for that contest and how he told himself that if he didn't make the top five, that he was going to quit bodybuilding and never compete again. So it's really a great insight into the mind of a champion. So let's listen to that.
The general vibe and opinion of people was this: yes, you're good, but you can't beat the Americans because they have all the publicity. Yeah, the publicity in the magazines is, you know, it makes a difference.
Yeah.
You don't know the judges. Yeah, you don't have any relationship with the judges. You don't know the judges. That's not going to help you. And you're from England.
Yeah.
So all these things are going to go against you, yeah? And I said, well, honestly, I'm just going to say that's bullshit, yeah? Because I think if you're good enough, you're good enough. And these just seem like excuses that I've heard from people in the past. You know, I didn't place well because of this or that, or standing in the fucking shadows at the end of the stage and I didn't get noticed or whatever. It's just, hey, man, if you're good enough, it doesn't matter if you're standing in the shadows.
Right.
You know, so I'm like, I got to just be that guy, you know?
Yeah.
I got to play that and I got to be that. Because if I'm like kind of okay, I could get overlooked. So, you know, that's why I took some time out from that British Championship. I think it was like more than 18 months to give everything I had to this first pro show. And I was running the gym, you know. And there weren't so many gyms around then in the 80s, so the gym was, you know, it was okay. It was giving me a decent living. You know, I had a nice place to live now. I had a car and all that stuff. And so I said, look, you know, I'm living here like a monk, yeah, and I've done this and we've got this far. And now it's like crunch time, yeah, because either I'm good enough to be a pro or I'm not. And I see so many people wasting their life and neglecting their family and other opportunities and all this stuff because they're living this dream and they think there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, but there's not, you know, and there never was and never is going to be.
Right.
And I don't want to be that guy either. So, you know, I had a family, I had a son, I had a wife, and, you know, they make sacrifices because of your lifestyle and everything. So got to be justified. So I said, to justify continue doing this and living this lifestyle, and given it everything I've got, I got a place in the top five of this first pro show. If I can't, then it's really telling me I don't have what it takes to be one of the best, to be really up there, to be in the Mr. Olympia and you know, to be earning good living from all this, which is, you know, in the end, it's got to be some payback.
Right.
So if I don't place in the top five, I'm not going to compete again. I didn't mean, hey, I'm not going to lift weights or nothing. Yeah, of course, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to train for myself. I'll probably open more gyms, and I wouldn't take steroids because I'm only taking them to compete, and that's the way I always approached it. So here's time to find out whether this is all worth it and whether I got what it takes. So that was really the night champions, you know, make or break. And, you know, history shows I was second.
All right, then in episode 2 of season 2, we got a chance to talk to Lee Haney, who was an 8-time Mr. Olympia, and Lee Haney is one of the greatest bodybuilders ever. And we talked about his whole career, of course, in this episode, but there was one part of the episode I thought was very, very interesting, where Lee talks about the ability to project on a bodybuilding stage, and he talks about different bodybuilders and how some of them could really project their aura and their charisma on a bodybuilding stage where other bodybuilders couldn't. So I thought this was really a fascinating part of our interview, and I wanted to share it with you guys. Here we go.
One thing that's different about a physique, you either have it or you don't have it, and that's the ability to project. That is something that is special and something that is very rare in physiques. Example, Frank Zane standing there athletically, Frank looks good. But when Frank Zane flexes, you say, where did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
How did this guy weigh only 195 pounds look like he now weighs 220?
Yeah.
When he's Robert Robinson standing there, looked great. He does a double bicep. What in the world? Where did that come from? Arnold, the same way, projection.
Mm-hmm.
Have the ability to project is not something you can train and get. You have to be born with that ability. But the muscles actually talk and speak a language of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I had that.
Hmm.
And so Rich didn't have that. Mike Christian didn't have that. Lee DeBrado, Lee projects very well. He projects very well, but he's a smaller guy projecting. A bigger guy projecting is a monster.
Yeah.
If you can get that, you know, the guys who have it. Then you have guys like Rolf Miller. Rolf didn't have a bit of Lou Ferrigno don't project. You know, Duren Yates is big, but he don't project.
Hmm.
Ronnie is a monster. He projects. He projects crazy. He's a whole helicopter. So that's something that you either have or you don't have.
Yeah. Well, I love what you just said about the classical physiques, and you added, you know, 2 or 3 pounds a year. I remember Frank Zane was like that during his reign when he won 77, 78, 79. He wouldn't put on a lot of size, but it would be 2 or 3 pounds, but it would make a difference. On a
everything in the right place.
Right.
Balance, you know, and it looked. I mean, he was out there. Then his presentation. Frank is a whole nother world.
Yeah.
Whole nother world.
Yeah.
Wow, with his projection, just absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
His presentation, you know, like I said, a presentation. I think that's what sort of gave him an edge above Robbie. You know, I think Robbie got the better physique, but the combination of Frank's ability to communicate his physique.
Yeah.
And the ability to project. Particularly project as a smaller guy.
Mm-hmm.
Bigger guy projecting, you sort of expect it. But a little guy projecting, you don't expect that.
Right.
So it's a whole nother shot.
Yeah.
I still prefer Robert Fazeek. I want to make that clear, though. You prefer Robert Fazeek.
Right. Now, you just mentioned Lee Labrada. How did you feel when he first came on the scene? I mean, he was a, you know, a great bodybuilder, smaller guy, but great symmetry, always came in condition, great posing.
Yeah. Lee, absolutely incredible. You know, I would say Lee and Rich were about, you know, were about the same. I would look at them in sort of the same light.
Mm-hmm.
Lee, you know, I projected better than Rich, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
He had the ability to project. You know, Rich was just ripped to pieces, you know, and just a very hard, he was a hard presenter too. It's the reason why I gave him the name the Dragon Slayer, because he would definitely slay you if you you weren't ready. He would get you.
Right.
Lee was of a, you know, just classical. He was very classical in his presentation and so forth.
Yeah.
A lot like Muhammad Mukawi.
Absolutely.
Bit, you know, different, but along those lines, you know, Rich wasn't a big guy. He was bigger than Lee. And he posed powerful, you know. So that was a little bit different, too different to style of physique, you know. And so you, I guess with the judges, they would have to sort of decide, make a decision on, okay, what are we looking for here? Because it could have gone either way.
Right.
And again, I felt my mass, and I overpowered Lee, like overpowered Rich. So, you know, I didn't never worry about either one of them.
Yeah.
Defeat me. Never was that a thought, you know.
Yeah.
All right, now we move over to season 3, which was about the 1981 Mr. Olympia, and this was a great series. We had several interviews with not only some of the competitors who were in the 1981 Mr. Olympia, but we also got a chance to talk to some of the judges. So this was really great because the 1981 Mr. Olympia is probably the most controversial Mr. Olympia ever, even more so than the 1980 Mr. Olympia. And I was actually at the show. I was only 17 years old, but I was living in Chicago at the time. So my dad was kind enough to take us over to Columbus, Ohio to see the show. And this was actually the fourth Mr. Olympia I saw, because I saw the Mr. Olympias that Frank Zane won from 1977 through 1979. And then in 1980, it was held in Sydney, Australia. So, of course, I didn't go to that one. But in 1981, he came back to Columbus, Ohio. And there was a lot of anticipation about that year because the 1980 Mr. Olympia was so controversial. And a lot of people felt that Arnold shouldn't have won that contest. So in 1981, it was rumored that Franco Colombo was going to be competing in the contest. And everybody thought, because Franco was Arnold's best friend, that the fix was in and Franco was automatically going to win it. And in fact, Boyer Coe, Mike Mentzer, and Frank Zane, who were three of the greatest bodybuilders at that time, all decided to boycott the Mr. Olympia and not compete in the show. So it was a lot of anticipation, a lot of controversy going into that contest. And I was there at the show. I was sitting, I think, like in the fourth or fifth row, because I had really good seats. And I saw the whole pre-judging, and I saw the whole night show. So I had my opinions of it. But we got a chance to talk to a lot of the other people that were at the contest. Gary Bartlett, who was a photographer, we talked to him. We talked to some of the judges. We talked to John Balick, who was also a photographer at the time for Weeders Magazine before he went on to own Iron Man Magazine. And in our first interview on episode 1 of the season 3, I got a chance to talk to Roger Schwab. And Roger was a guest several times on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast in this past year. But he was the head judge at the 1981 Mr. Olympia. So he helped Ben Weeder with the selection of the judges. And he was also right on stage and helped to organize everything and do the call-outs. You know, when the judges were calling for the call-outs, Roger was the one that coordinated all of that. So Roger was right on stage during the action, and it was a fascinating interview. So what we did with Roger was we analyzed the judges' score sheets. Even though Roger himself was not judging the show, we got to analyze all of the judges' score sheets from all three rounds for all the competitors. So it was really, really a great interview. If you guys haven't heard this one, please go back and listen to it. So in this part of our clip with Roger, we're going to talk about his opinion of what happened at the most controversial Mr. Olympia ever and where he would have placed the competitors. So here we go.
Pretty skeptical about this whole thing. Like, oh, we don't want another controversy for our biggest contest ever, right? Before going into the contest.
I think that you're right in what you're saying, but I really think that it didn't matter to the Wieters if Franco won that contest. The exposure in the magazines was great, even with the disaster in Australia. Bodybuilding was still at its almost, you know, it might have been slightly past its peak of the late 70s, but still right near the zenith of the golden age. And people were still reading the magazines. You know, I'm correct, because at Columbus, every seat was taken in that house. I mean, it was a wild crowd. And the enthusiasm for bodybuilders back then was everybody had their favorites. It could have been, you know, Boyer Co. And if Mike Mentzer and Frank Zane had entered, no doubt it would have been the greatest contest of all time. Yeah. But they were, in retrospect, they were smart and they stayed out and they didn't think they would get a fair shake because Arnold had something to do with it. But I would say to you that although Arnold was backstage, when I was the head judge, whatever I told him, however I told him I wanted the lineup or how they're to do the mandatory, so forth and so on, he was in agreement with. So he was there and his presence was felt, and I'm sure he wanted Franco to win the contest, but he never interfered.
Okay, so now you were on stage, right? You were directing.
I was actually on the stage next to these guys. So they would come out from the wings and they would walk up to the podium, and 4,500 people would be seeing the competitor and myself. And I would give each competitor sort of a pep talk up there saying, you know, everybody is watching you. Hit your poses hard. Hold your contracted position. Make sure, and this is something I would tell every competitor all the time, make sure that when you're going from pose to pose, you keep your abdominal muscles tightened, because there's always a tendency, as you know, to relax, especially when they're standing around in the wings. You could, somebody taking a picture backstage could see somebody relaxed, and you really wanted for this day in your career to be at your best every second, and it took a lot of mental focus. So I tried to instill that upon them when they were up on the podium and doing the 7 mandatory poses.
So from your perspective then, Roger, looking at the competitors, give us your review of the top competitors and where you thought they were going to place based on the prejudgment.
Okay. To me, this is just my opinion then.
Right.
It hasn't really changed. Danny Padilla, I believe, weighed 155 pounds, and he had never really competed less than 180 or even a little bit heavier. And you know, besides the fact that he was 5'3", he was almost in perfect proportion for his height, and every body part had a long muscle belly and a short tendon. Mm-hmm. So his bicep, triceps, his pecs, his abs, his quads, and his calves. And if you take off the intercellular fat, he was at his epitome of muscularity. His face was very, very drawn, with his cheekbones, his high cheekbones drawn, but he was not missing anything. He had my vote right from the beginning, although I don't think most of the audience thought so. In second place, I had Tom Platz. I think the Platz, this was definitely his best contest. He was in his best shape of his life in this very day. Unfortunately, again in 1982, when I was a head judge in Wembley, England, Platz had torn his right biceps at Gold's Gym, I believe, doing dumbbell flies.
Yeah.
Got caught in the stretch position with his arms out to the side and tore the insertion of his bicep, and didn't have it repaired for 1982, and like Dorian Yates subsequently. So Platz was at his zenith, but still at his very, very best, and he was very, very good. His lower body was, in my opinion, symmetrically was not Danny Padilla.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to take anything away from Platz. I had third place, I had Roy Callender. I thought Callender was tremendously muscular, the best that I had seen him.
Right,
you know, genetics deserted him below the knee,
yeah.
And like a lot of black bodybuilders, his calves were high with a long tendon, like Bill Grant, I would say. Grant had tremendous genetics also and was a tremendous bodybuilder. And so Callender, zilcho fat, looked very, very muscular and felt great about it. Fourth, I had Dickerson fourth, and I might have made a mistake there. In retrospect, Josip Wilkos was in really, really good shape. He plays sixth, but really had no weaknesses. He just didn't have the greatest body parts that he stood out. So Wilkos could have been fourth, or Dickerson, and I had Franco fifth or sixth. Franco's muscularity of his pecs was almost as good as it was at his best, in my opinion, 1976. And he could do nothing about this, but his legs, after the terrible accident in the World's Strongest Men, his legs really weren't anywhere near the other top competitors. Plus, he had a case of gyno in his right pec, and he was muscular and great, but he, in my opinion, he wasn't Mr. Olympia that day. And it was very sad because I had spent some time with him in Philadelphia before the contest, and I told him, you know, you have a great chance of winning this contest, and he did win, but it was a humiliating win, I would say, all around.
So now, take us through your opinion of how it went at the prejudging, because the crowd was really, really vocal, and it was kind of up in the air of who's going to win. And I agree with you. I think the top three was Padilla, Platts, and Callender. So tell us your opinion about what the crowd reaction was and who you thought was leading the pack just from the prejudging and from the crowd reaction.
Well, since I saw the scores in all the rounds, I knew exactly what was going on.
Okay.
But
did you see the scores after every round?
I saw the scores every round. As a matter of fact, I was one who added up the scores after every round.
Okay.
And trust me, I knew it was going to be imminent disaster. And there was nothing I could do about it, and nor was there anything I anticipated to do about it, because that wasn't my job. I was doing my job.
As a head judge, you can't step in and say, hey, your scores are out of line.
No, I can't. I mean, because these, between you and I don't know if it was public information, but the Japanese judge, Mrs. Matayuma, we didn't count her scores at all.
Oh, okay.
She wasn't qualified. She shouldn't have been there.
She was that far up.
Yeah, and it wasn't her gig. I just don't understand why she was there. You know, this, of course, is 30-some-odd years later. But regardless, you know, bodybuilding crowds in the 70s and 80s were quite sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
Only after Dorian and how great Dorian got in 1993, the crowd started really going in the 90s for tremendous mass.
Right.
But in the 70s and 80s, I think the crowd had a very sophisticated eye, and you can usually tell by the initial call-outs and the initial reception by the crowd who the favorites were. And in this contest, I believe right off the bat that the favorite was Tom Platts. Platts just looked completely different than he had before, and I think, again, Danny and Callender had initial great receptions. You know, also, John, as you know, the magazine exposure has so much to do about crowd reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And the magazine's Callender was never featured in the magazines anywhere near the way Platts was or Arnold was back in those days. So Callender didn't have the recognition factor, but as soon as he came on the stage and he knew he was ready for this, he got a great applause. Franco, when he first came out, got great applause, but it seemed to stifle somewhat as he went on.
Yeah.
And Wilkos, as good as he is, was very symmetrical, but didn't have that wow factor, if you know what I meant.
Mm-hmm.
So right off the bat, it was Platts with his thighs, Danny with his symmetry, and Callender with his muscularity.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, then in episode 3 of the 1981 Mr. Olympia series, we got a chance to talk to Danny Padilla and his good friend Jim Rockel. And Jim Rockel was one of the top judges with the IFBB for many, many years. And he's been a lifelong friend of Danny. I think they've known each other for about 40 years at least. So Danny, of course, was one of the best bodybuilders ever in the 1970s. And everybody feels that he reached his lifetime best condition at the 1981 Mr. Olympia. And a lot of people, a lot of fans, and a lot of people who were there felt that Danny got really ripped off by only placing fifth, and that he should be Mr. Olympia for 1981. So Danny's, of course, had a long career, and he's got a great personality, and I never had a chance to talk to him before, so this was a real pleasure. But in this clip, we don't really talk about the 1981 Olympia, but Danny does talk about some of the other competitions he did, including being eliminated from the 1975 Mr. Olympia, which was the contest that was covered in the movie Pumping Iron. And Danny was supposed to be in the Mr. Universe that year, which was held on the same weekend. And he was going to be the lightweight competitor representing the USA because he won the IFBB Mr. USA that year. So he was automatically on the team, and then he gets all the way to South Africa, and then he wasn't allowed to compete. So he's going to talk about that, and then he's going to talk about his experience competing in the 1977 Mr. Universe, which was held in France, and how he almost didn't make it over there. So Danny's had a lot of problems in his bodybuilding career. So here he talks about those two events, the 1975 Mr. Universe and then the 1977 Mr. Universe. Here we go.
Saying how great you were and, you know, that you had all the potential in the world.
Yeah, I was lucky because at 5'2", you know, you just don't, it's hard. And I was blessed in the sense of I knew I couldn't out-muscle every guy, but I could out-pretty him. So I believed in working the whole body, so from the ankles right up.
Mm-hmm.
So when I would get on stage, you could never tell my height until I was next to somebody.
Right.
You could never guess my height.
And then later that year, Danny, you were chosen to go to Pretoria, South Africa, correct, to compete in the Mr. Universe.
Yeah, well, that was another, listen, I call it the Trail of Tears for me. Because legally, I was the lightweight representation for Mr. Universe. Legally,
right.
I in that show because I won the USA, and Joe Weider flew me to LA, and believe it or not, I did some Pump and Iron video. In fact, that was where I first saw Mike Mentzer. He's in the background. A lot of people don't know that, but he was there.
Mm-hmm.
And all trained and got ready for the show. We flew to Africa a week before the show, and then the morning of the show, I was told that I wasn't going to compete. I was devastated. I couldn't believe it. I ate breakfast. I went to get on the bus. They said, listen, you're not going to be allowed to compete. I said, well, what's this about? And nobody would explain anything to me. And then, of course, I went to Ben, and he was like, you know, he had no answer. He was upset. I was upset. I wanted to choke him, so they had to drag me away. And I'm sitting there with Oscar State at the doorway, and he's saying to me, aren't you going to compete? And I said, well, America doesn't want me on their team after they chose me. And so Oscar State said, well, what do you mean they don't want you? I said, well, aren't you part of this? He goes, no, I don't know what you're talking about. You're on the charter. You have to be on that. So Coach was walking by, and he said to me, I said, nobody wants me. He says, we'll take you. We don't have a lightweight. So Oscar says to me, I don't know how we could do this. He says, where was your, you know, parents? I said, well, my dad was born in Spain. My mother was in Puerto Rico, and he had to cross through Portugal to get there, right? So he said, before you're that dumb, we're going to let you in. And if you look at photos, I'm carrying the banner for Portugal.
Really? Wow.
So now Arnold and the guys are laughing their head off. They're looking. They say, how the hell did he get it? And the funny thing about it was, it wasn't until years later, because I was blaming poor Ed Jubenville. He was the coach for us. And at that time, we had Ken Waller, myself in the light, and Robbie in the middle. So it would have been the sport. We would have been the first team ever to win all three divisions.
Right.
Mike Katz and Ken Waller. And so they put two heavyweights. And the process was supposed to be that he would and Waller would pose down and they would pick one of them. Instead, they put them both in. And what I was told 20 years later was that it was possibly Butler from Pump and Iron who said, why not put the two heavyweights and let's get rid of Danny because he's young and he's good and he can come back next year. So I got on Portugal's team, and basically I was winning. I would have won the universe.
Yeah.
And they stopped the show, and they stripped me again. I was kicked out.
So were you actually in the prejudging then, Danny? Or did you get up there and you were posing?
I won round one, round two. I was going to be Mr. Universe, and then I think New England protested. They had to stop, and they stripped me.
Yeah. The eventual winner of the short class, he came from England, right, Will Sylvester?
Yeah, you got it. I'm going to get beat that night. So it's the story of my life.
Yeah, I always wonder what happened with that, because I remember you were in the movie Pumping Iron, where you guys were talking about
Ed Cordy and Franco posing.
Yeah, I was in the whole movie, and then a lot of it was taken out because it was an embarrassment to the actors. They were not. They can't show it. If I could get the original cut, what a lot of fun I would have.
Well, you had a fantastic career. You won the took first in your short class in the Mr. America in '76, and then you ended up winning the Mr. America, beating out Roger Callard and Pete Grubkowski in '77, and then you won the Universe that year, right?
That was another trail of tears. After I had won the show, there was a little protest, you know, because, you know, they were upset that Roger didn't win.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was in the shower. I had to come back out and pose again.
Really? You had to pose again?
I had to pose again. I had soap in my hair. That story never got out either, but it was true.
Who was protesting that?
I think Roger, and I think at the time he had Arnold pushing for him because he was Arnold's training partner. They were kind of trying to nudge, and I was elected again, Mr. America. You know, Frank Zane, the guy said, nah, he's the winner. We're not taking him off.
Zane was a judge there?
I think Zane, I'm trying to remember, Franco, who ran the show, was a judge. And somebody, I forget who the judges were, but they couldn't take me out.
Let me ask you about that Universe, too, Danny, because you went in '76 when it was in Montreal, and you were surprised. Mohamed McAway, what did you think of him? He shocked everybody that year, huh?
McAway was a tremendous bodybuilder. He had a tremendous upper body, but very weak legs. He just never had legs. And he caught me. I was heavy. You know, he was muscular. I was huge. The crowd wanted me to win because I was so big. I overshadowed him like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
But he won the show. And I, you know, deservingly, he was cut. He looked very good. I was huge, smooth, and based on, during that era, you know, guys that were big and round were winning. You didn't have to be really cut.
Mm-hmm.
He came in looking pretty cut, and he won the show. And I wasn't surprised by it. I mean, I thought he was pretty good, and the fact that he won didn't shock me at all.
But then you came back in '77, and then you beat him there.
Crushed him there. And in that universe, that was another trail of tears. At the time, me and Cal Skellig flew from L.A. to New York. There was some people, and we won the berth to go to the universe. And when we finished that show, we were supposed to go to the airport and fly to Europe, and there was no airline ticket. So we're at the airport with no ticket, and we're calling calling the promoter of the show, and then he said, well, you got to call the IPV because they're supposed to supply the ticket. We called Ben and them, and they said, well, they're supposed to supply the ticket. So we were there we lost the day sitting in the airport. We said we're going to get a lawyer and sue. All of a sudden, a ticket showed up. We got a ticket to go to Europe. We get to, I believe it was England, and then there was an airline strike. So we were stuck at the airport.
Damn.
So we spent like 3-4 days flying while everybody was already over in France. Then there was another strike. We were able to somehow get on the plane. We finally got to France. We didn't have a room to go into, so we had to go find out what the hell was going on there. And then we had to go to a meeting. It was a long process. So me and Cal Skellig went 3 or 4 days hardly eating, okay? I mean, it was the funniest thing ever. In fact, in France, you know, we weren't able to shower, so I'm sitting in the sink half nude trying to wash myself, walking in the bathroom crying with laughter. And then, of course, the assistant there said, hey, you can't be doing this. You got to get dressed. And they said, who the hell are you? We told them who we were. So they got us on a plane and got us over to Nice. And then another shock went because I beat McCowie, that was shocking, and then, of course, Kelly, he beat Mike Mencher, which was, you know, everybody thought Mike was going to win that night, and he got beat.
So Mike wasn't in the airport with you guys, huh? Did he get flown out separately?
He was there prepped like he won the show.
How'd you get along with Cal? He was always a favorite bodybuilder of mine when I was growing up, and I thought it was great when he beat Mencher in that universe because it was such an upset.
I got along with everybody, but I helped Cal Skellig maintain and fight for the right. Because, you know, it was tough what we went through. We were helping each other. And Mike was one of my best friends back then, good friend of mine. So it was like I was all about the time, you know, I got to stay in shape. So we barely ate. You know, we were on low carbs. And then that fact, we got in, finally we got to our room Thursday. Friday was, we had to get ready to get ready for the show. So we were walking around and doing jogging to make sure. And then there was the weigh-in. And in fact, when I got weighed in that morning, I talked to McCauley. He came over, you know, said to me, "You want chocolate?" And I said, "No, I'm okay." And I was eating peanut butter jelly. He says to me, "Should you be eating that? Aren't you afraid?" I said, "Champions can eat anything they want. I'm not worried about it." So then it was funny because they made you strip to weigh yourself back then.
Uh-huh.
Sat on the scale, and with my outfit on, I weighed 163. They made me strip. They said, no, everybody has to be in there. They made us, you know, strip. It is basically to look at the guys. So
yeah.
When I got on, weighed in again, they said, weigh him again because he's too big to weigh 162. They didn't believe that I weighed 162. Bodybuilding's always been rough on me.
All right, in episode 5 of the 1981 Mr. Olympia series, we got a chance to talk to Roy Callender. And Roy was also one of the top bodybuilders who competed at that 1981 Mr. Olympia. Roy also, like Danny and like Tom Platz, Roy achieved his lifetime best condition at that contest. So Roy also, like Danny, had an extensive career. He started competing in the 1960s in the NABBA Mr. Universe contest in London. And he was also in the 1968 IFBB Mr. Universe in Miami Beach. And this was notable because this was the competition. This was Arnold Schwarzenegger's first contest in the United States. And it was his first IFBB contest. And Arnold, as we all know, got beat that night by Frank Zane. And he was very, very upset because Arnold was huge. He was about 250 pounds. And Frank Zane, I think, was only about 180 pounds. So Roy had the chance to share a room with Arnold that weekend in the same hotel. So he talks about Arnold and how he took that loss that night of the 1968 Mr. Universe.
And Roy, if you could share that story with us when you competed in Miami Beach and a year later in 1968. And that was the infamous contest where Frank Zane beat out Arnold. And you got to share a room with Arnold that weekend, right?
Well, he came over. He knew me. I already was sharing a room with Nobuo Takemoto from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And when he finally was, he felt strange. He couldn't speak English very well. He wanted, and they told him, "Well, Roy is here." He said, "Roy is here. Well, I want to stay with Roy." So there's a knock on the door. He came in, and I already had a roommate.
Mm-hmm.
And they explained to the Japanese, the little Japanese guy, "Listen, Arnold would like to stay with Roy." That's funny to see. Because before the words could be out of their mouth, this Japanese kid started bawling and packing his suitcase at the same time, man. And, it was funny to see.
Yeah.
And about 5 minutes, he was out of the room with his suitcase, and they took him to another room, and Arnold bumped up with me.
Mm-hmm.
We were together for the next 2 weeks.
And what did you feel about, I mean, you looked really good in that contest, too, Roy. I think you only took, like, sixth place, but... You look great from the pictures.
Little fat kid. I was a little fat kid with a swollen head.
Uh-huh.
But I went over because I wasn't supposed to be there. I was supposed to be back at my job because I had applied to go to the Mr. World in New York.
Okay.
So Joe saw me and he said, "I didn't know you looked that good. Listen, you want to hang around and go to Miami? Go to Mr. Universe in Miami? Have you ever been to Miami?" I said, "No, I would love that." So he ended up making a phone call, putting me on a plane. And when I got there, the courtesies were extended. They had some money to pick me up and stuff, put me away.
Hmm.
First time I'd ever set foot in Florida.
Wow. That's crazy that Joe Weider actually called your job and to get you to come out there and compete.
Yeah.
So what did you think of the United States the first time when you saw it?
Overawed, man. I lived in London. I was overawed. I heard a lot about it. I was overawed to see cops with guns. And I think I went up to a cop once and asked him a question. And when he turned to me, he was chewing his usual gum, but his hand was on his gun.
Hmm.
That was one of the things that stuck with me.
Yeah.
Forever, to this day. And the other one, this was 1968. The other one was, I was in a cab taking me back to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped at a traffic light, and this guy ran over from the corner. Anybody wants to buy a formal shirt? You know, these frilly shirts that you used to wear with the formal attire?
Mm-hmm.
3 shirts for $20. So he held up this thing, and I pulled up the $20. I was so excited. Paid the $20. And then I got to the airport and opened the package. It was just 3 shirt fronts. Those things live with me. They're funny. They live in forever, man.
And so what was your opinion of Arnold losing to Zane that year? I mean, I think everybody agrees that he really wasn't in shape. You know, he just came off his second Mr. Universe win in London, but he was kind of big and bulky, right?
European-style physique?
Yeah.
Big, round, big round and white. Jin came in tight, bronzed, and sharp, you know? Typical Adonis-type physique.
Yeah.
He was an easy winner for me. Mm-hmm. And Arnold wasn't used to losing, man. And when he went back, he went back to the room. This guy was asleep. We had a big meal. He ate part of it. He went back to the room. The guy just laid on his back, pissed off. Said, "Heavy, let's go to sleep, man. I'm going to turn over to go to sleep." He switched off the light. Just about got off in the la-la land. And I heard this guy saying, "Poxy fucking chutches." Poxy fucking chutches. I said, "Arnold, competition is over, man. We got to shoot tomorrow. I think you should go to sleep." He said, "Yeah, you're right." He turned over, Grant. Then a couple of minutes later, I heard him mumble on his breath, "I'm going to be big in this fucking America. I'm going to be big in this fucking America." I said, "Arnold, go to sleep, man." And that was it. He went to sleep next morning. He got up. We all know how that turned out.
Right.
"I'm going to be big in this. We know that turned out."
Yeah, that's exactly. Something
I always say to myself, he said it, and he meant it. I wish it could be like that.
So, Roy, you competed until the, 71, and then you took a break, right? And then you tried pro wrestling and stuff for a while, and then you came back into bodybuilding in the late 70s, in 77.
Yeah, to represent Canada at Miss Universe in France. Then I really got the bug because Arnold was on my case. He saw me in Montreal the previous year. Came over to the 1976 Miss Universe at the Olympic Stadium.
Yeah.
And came over. When I went up to the stadium from I lived in Montreal, so I went over to see it. He said, "Roy Callender, why aren't you training? You know what you're throwing away? He made fun of my outfit, made fun of my arms." Usually, all the time his arms are around me.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Next time I see you, I hope you have at least another 60 or 80 pounds on, or something like that."
Mm-hmm.
But it encouraged me, man, and I really had the desire after that, and I started training. That was one reason. The other reason was I couldn't understand why a Canadian couldn't win something.
Yeah.
They all ended up, they'll be happy with top six and top five and that stuff.
Okay, now in this part of the interview with Roy Callender, Roy talks about the 1981 Mr. Olympia, and he talks about as he was preparing for the show, he knew he was in top shape, and then he talks about a little bit about the contest itself. So here we go.
So as the contest is getting closer, I'm sure either Boyer Co. or Mike Mentzer or Zane called you and told you that they were boycotting the show, and I think they tried to get other bodybuilders to boycott the 81 Olympia also, right?
Yeah, that's right.
What did Boyer say to you or whoever it was that called you?
He said, "Well, in light of what happened, he thinks all the other guys had decided that they're not going, and he wanted to inform me that it's up to, you know, he thinks that it would be in the best interest of the sport if I joined them and just didn't show up." For me, it wasn't a no-brainer. For me, it was a no-brainer.
Right.
For someone who was standing on the outside, it would have not been, but they had no insight as to my relationship with Arnold.
Uh-huh.
And if I have a relationship with, if I call someone a friend and they have not proven to me otherwise, they will always be my friend.
Right.
So I stayed in my original thing. I told Arnold I was coming. And
So after your good placing in 1980, I mean, you were right up there with the best of them. Did you feel that you had a shot at actually winning the show in 1981?
For that reason, yes, because I figured, okay, there's not going to be another Arnold there.
Mm-hmm.
I really got into preparation. I didn't say it's going to be my last shot, but I said, if I'm going to go for this thing, I don't see anything that is going to harm me here. Let me go for it. So
yeah.
I really devoted a lot of time and energy and planning into it, and not exactly as I wanted, but physically, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're in the gym and you're getting ready, and I know this from when I've competed before, and you know, when I'm getting ready for a show and I'm really ready and I know I'm ready. So were you in the gym in California, and what was the feedback you were getting from the people around you? Because they had to all be like, "Wow, Roy, you're looking better than ever."
No. You want to hear something funny? I left Essen, flew to San Jose to guest pose at the Mr. USA.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was Paul Love was the promoter. I guest pose at the Miss USA. And after the Miss USA, I think Berta Fox was there. They thought, you know, you're pretty good, but you need to get a little sharper. But I didn't say anything, but I knew what I was going to do. And by the time I was ready to leave San Jose, I was ready. I was like a leaf at the end of summer.
Yeah.
All dried out, yeah. I was ready. So when I got to Columbus, it was a little cooler. I started to fill out exactly at the right time.
Right.
I felt so optimistic about my chances.
What was your weight for that show, Roy? Do you remember?
What did I weigh?
Yeah.
Before I started my final preparation, I weighed about 228, 229. Before I started, I think about final 3 weeks now, because I spent 3 weeks or so at Paul Love's place and at his gym. So I would say about 229. When I got there, it was about 219.
Okay. Wow, that's pretty big for 1981, right?
Yeah, I thought it was.
Yeah.
That's why it was a disappointment. That's why it was a disappointment. I had never learned as much. And Arnold had helped me in some of the things, because when I gave him a call, he'd really go into the details of what I should do and what I shouldn't do. I had never gone into such detail, man. Naturally, I'm older. I've learned a lot more. I've been around the guys. I've read a little bit more. I didn't have to do a lot of experimenting, except in pushing myself a little harder, but didn't have to do a lot of experimenting at all. I had taken all those years of experience, and they said, okay, we're not going that road again. We're going this road. It all worked.
Yeah.
And as you know, most of us, we had to work by trial and error. Well, everything is really, but you have to eliminate as many trials as you can.
And right. There was no coaches back then like there is today.
That's it. You better look in the mirror. You better think.
Mm-hmm.
You better plan. You better make it make sense on paper.
Frank Zane advised you on your trunks, right, Roy?
But that one, yes. Oh, yes. Tremendous help, man. I can't really put into words the amount of cooperation you used to get. And this is for that reason. One of the reasons why I felt a bit like if I was a Judas. Then Boyer asked me not to go, and I said, no, I said, okay, I'll go, but I had promised Arnold I'm coming. So either I deceived my friend, or I deceived a group of fellow professionals. And I preferred not to deceive my friend.
So right.
I went. That is,
what did Zane tell you about the trunks?
Oh, Roy, first time I ever heard it. So that is a sign of my maturity. He said, Roy, listen, man. When you go on that stage, you have a great physique. This side, the only thing I see wrong, you break it in two. You go, yeah, great physique. You go on the stage in red trunks and stuff. You look like two pieces.
Yeah.
If I were you, I would wear black. No, I'm saying what the hell is he getting at? I'd wear black, and you look like one great, magnificent piece of ebony up there.
Yeah.
And I said with a smile, a fake smile, okay, yeah, it's a good idea. And I went home, I laid down, I thought about it. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'll get the trunks made for you. And you know what? His mother made them.
Yeah, yeah.
And he brought them and gave them to me and said, okay, this is how I'm going. I looked at myself in the mirror. I liked it. I was doing my practice and my posing. I liked it. This is something I couldn't learn in Quebec.
Yeah.
So I went with it. And I was very, very pleased with the picture that I saw after. The rest is history, actually. I was very skeptical, then thrilled, then really, really, really started to understand something else about bodybuilding. And then I understood why a lot of the white guys got themselves brown and wore brown shorts. This is the idea. guys had since gone away from that, a few of them, but I would not have gone away from that ever.
Yeah, that's right. I remember, now that you said that, I remember Zane's mother used to always make his posing trunks and when he was winning that Olympia, his trunks fit perfect. They were like custom made for him. I mean, they looked perfect for his physique.
So how am I going to tell him, Frank, you don't know what you're talking about?
No, right.
he got my trunks made for me free.
And
Wow, that's great. And I agree with him. When I saw you in that contest, you did look like more ripped, and maybe the trunks had something to do with it, you know, because they're same color as your skin.
One piece.
Yeah, one piece, right.
All right, and then finally, the last clip that we're going to share with you on part one of our anniversary show, we had a chance to talk to Winston Roberts, and Winston Roberts was one of the top judges in the IFBB during the 1970s and 1980s. He is from Barbados originally, I believe, and then he became really good friends with Ben Weider. And unfortunately, Winston passed away not long after we did this interview. I think it was only about a month or 2 months after we did this interview, Winston passed away. I don't really know what he passed away from. He didn't sound sick when we did the interview, so it was very unfortunate to hear of Winston's passing. But I am glad that I did get a chance to meet him and to talk to him, and we were able to do this interview. So here's a portion of the interview we talked about. We talked about with Winston, of course, his whole career in bodybuilding. But toward the end of our interview, we got a chance to talk to him about the 1981 Mr. Olympia because the judges were obviously very criticized for this decision. So I got a chance, a rare opportunity, to talk to Winston Roberts directly and ask him why he placed everybody the way he placed them. And he went round by round, and he went over all the top competitors, and he gave us his opinion on why he placed each competitor where he did. When you listen to this clip, you're probably going to disagree with what he said about Tom Platz and what he said about Danny Padilla, but it was a great opportunity to get to talk directly to Winston. I should have maybe pushed him a little bit harder in some of the comments he made about Danny or about Tom, but I did want to hear his opinion on what he had to say in regards to where he placed each competitor, so it was really interesting to get this. So here is our interview with Winston Roberts, who was a judge at the 1981 Mr. Olympia.
So anyway, I know you want to talk about the 1991 Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. So these guys came out.
Okay.
Look, we want to be objective.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of hysteria and a lot of favoritism that a lot of the people writing about it and talking about it online and so on.
Yeah, still one of the most controversial.
Some of them weren't there. Now you said you were there.
Right.
You were a young bodybuilder, so I don't know how acute your senses were at the time. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, to be honest with you, here's how I saw it.
Okay.
Franco, probably the hardest bodybuilder in the show.
Okay.
Now, okay, he didn't have the detail in the legs that a Chris Dickerson had, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But he was in very, very good condition.
Yeah, I agree.
So obviously, he was going to be considered. And he had that trademark cut that went right across his chest. Remember that?
Yeah, sure.
So that was a very attractive feature. He had great arms, great deltoids.
Yeah.
His back went, when he turned his back, his back went right down into his waist.
Right.
He had a lot of great features that made him look fantastic. His abs were in pretty good shape.
Mm-hmm.
He was definitely top three right off the bat.
Okay.
See, because when I'm judging and the guys come out, I put an asterisk beside their name.
Okay.
I go, this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy. And then, so I maybe try to get top three. And then I put a check mark for guys that are lower. So I might have three asterisks and then three check marks.
Okay.
And a guy that in the other three that looks pretty good might get a double check mark. So I say, I got to consider him in the top three.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm doing my comparisons, I got to bring him in. And take a look and see what he looks like. Because a bodybuilder by himself looks fantastic until you put him next to somebody else. And then you go, oh, okay.
Right.
He's not running. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So Franco was definitely in the top three. Tom Platz, of course. Tom Platz came in with great fanfare.
Mm-hmm.
Because his amazing legs. My opinion, no symmetry.
Okay.
You can't come into a show where your legs are so huge that your upper body doesn't match up. So the great feature on his physique, which was so attractive, technically becomes a weakness.
Okay.
Because it throws the symmetry right off. And I remember in my head when he turned, when he went on his knees to do a few poses, side chest and so on, these humongous leg biceps were hanging down. They look like growth. They look like, I go, what the heck? You know, you can't tell someone this is the greatest physique in the world.
Mm-hmm.
His arms were okay, and at that time he hadn't suffered the rip that he eventually suffered in his right bicep.
Yeah, that
and
was the next
once
year.
That happened, he was finished.
Yeah.
The thing is, the legs were just, I mean, it's okay to have those great legs, but the upper body has to match it.
Yeah.
Has to match it. And they didn't. His calves were good. His calves were okay.
Did you think he improved his upper body from previous showing?
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, he was close.
Yeah.
I mean, face it, he was obviously one of the top three guys we're looking at.
Okay.
Now you look at the guy like Danny Padilla. Danny Padilla, again, was one of those guys you would be hoping for. I knew Danny very well. And I hope Danny comes in, he's full and he's, you know, great symmetry. I hope he comes in ready.
Got everything, yeah.
And then he was a little off. If you look at a double bicep of Danny and a double bicep of Chris Dickerson, a double bicep of the other guy, when he brings up his arms, he gets washed out.
Hmm.
And then on top of that, his trunks didn't fit. You're coming into the Mr. Olympia, man. You know, that's one of the things about Frank Zane. You knew that in those early years, Frank Zane had his trunks made to measure by his design. You're coming in, you got to prepare in every which way.
Right, right.
You got to come in. You can't come in with your trunks hanging off your body. And, you know, it takes away from that finish.
Did you think Danny was just too lean? Maybe he took it too far?
Yeah, he didn't bring that size that we know that he can bring.
Okay.
And then he didn't have that final sharpness that we know that he can bring.
Okay.
Still one of the top guys. I would have loved to give it to Danny. I'd love to give it to Danny. Uh-huh. I really love that, you know? And then again, it's that small man thing. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Bodybuilding is about big guys, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
And my friend, my great friend, Roy Callender.
Yeah.
Roy was in good shape. And he posed really well.
Mm-hmm.
But you know that Roy has bow legs, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
See? And people don't think of those things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to take, I mean, not that that was the reason why he didn't do better, but is a guy with bow legs the best body in the world? You see, these are things you have to think about.
Okay.
You know? And I know that he wasn't as sharp as he was a few days before. And you can't really use that either because you're not judging him against himself like a few days before.
Mm-hmm.
But between you and I, he was caught eating a bunch of donuts midnight the night before.
Really? Really? Wow.
Because Jimmy Caruso was his trainer.
Right.
And Jimmy caught him in the hallway with a bunch of donuts.
Oh, no.
And we know that he wasn't as sharp as he could have been. But he was sharp. He was good.
Yeah.
He was, I mean, let's face it, he was one of the, I mean, you know, people don't realize that these are the best guys in the world.
Right, best of the best.
You can't say, somebody effed up, you know, he should have won. I mean, years after Roy, we used to wear a T-shirt that said, "The unofficial Mr. Olympia."
Right.
and that's great stuff, because these are the best bodies in the world. Roy was amazing. He was definitely fantastic, and he posed to classical music, which Jimmy Caruso put together. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy is the greatest posing teacher in the world.
Yeah.
You should get a hold of Jimmy Caruso.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to him.
Jimmy Caruso, by my standards, was the best photographer in physique the world has ever seen.
Yeah, that's what Roy said, too.
And by the way, the best trainer.
Wow.
World has ever seen. Nobody knows how to train someone like Jimmy Caruso. By the way, when Arnold won in 1980 in South Africa, the only person who knew he was going to compete, but probably one of two people, was Jimmy Caruso and probably Joe Weider.
Really?
Because Arnold flew Jimmy down to California to take his pictures.
Oh, yeah, I remember those pictures. Yeah, I remember the studio shots that he took.
Yeah, he took those pictures.
Right.
Of Arnold. And he told Jimmy, "You got to keep it quiet. Not allowed to tell it." But Jimmy told me, so I knew he was going.
Right.
But Jimmy is, you know, I can't oversing his phrases. He's fantastic.
Yeah, I would love to talk to him one day. He's a true legend.
To him. Now, to get down to how the show came out.
We did talk about Chris Dickerson, though. What did you think about him?
Chris Dickerson? Okay, I was one that voted Chris Dickerson first.
Yeah, I saw that.
He had great symmetry, the narrow waist, the wide lats, the wide shoulders. A weakness that Chris has, of course, is the arms.
Mm-hmm.
But then Franco's arms were not so fantastic either, were they?
No.
I think the best arms in the show would have been Roy Callender's arms.
Yeah.
Very hard to beat. So you can't fault the guy. His arms were okay. Like I said, good enough. Good enough for the bone structure and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the abs and the nice calves, and he looked good. He maybe could have been a little tighter.
Mm-hmm.
Why did I put him above Franco? I actually had Franco in third place.
Okay.
And in second place, I had Platsy. Wait a minute, sorry.
I'm looking at the score sheets, and these are going by the rounds. And in round one, you had Danny and Chris Dickerson with 20s, and then you gave Tom Platz, Roy Callender, and Franco a 19.
Okay. So I had Chris Dickerson the 20s.
Yeah,
you know,
and Danny.
Let me put it this way. You know what the elephant in the room is?
What?
It's the judging system.
Yeah, me and Roger talked about that.
That was the last year. In fact, we only used that judging system for a couple of years, and we realized it was flawed.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what the flaw was. A judge was allowed to give his first place winner 20.
Yeah.
Now, 20 didn't mean the guy is perfect. It meant he's the guy you think is the best on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we allowed, which was a mistake, because some other people got involved in the decision-making, like Dennis Stallard of Ireland or Scotland or something, and Oscar and some others, and they allowed the judge, you could give as many 20 scores as you want.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was an out for the judges, for some of the judges.
Say,
yeah. I can't decide who's better. You know, is it Danny or Franco or whoever? So I'm going to give them 320s.
Yeah.
Now that's the judge that's copping out.
Right.
You can't make, it means you can't make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
So we had judges ended up giving two two bodybuilders 20s, which means you're leaving the decision to the other judges.
Yeah.
You see?
Right.
And
right.
So with that kind of score, you know, like a Frank, I don't have the detail of how Franco Fassi scored the other athletes, but Franco Fassi, okay, he's obviously a friend of Franco.
Yeah, he just had Franco with the 20. He didn't give anybody else a 20.
He's Italian, right?
Mm-hmm.
He maybe was not so much a friend of Franco Colombo as the fact that they were both Italian.
Right.
And so the thing is, Franco Colombo was in good shape.
Mm-hmm.
And being in good shape, you can say he was okay, justified. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Giving him a 20. Danny Padilla took himself out of contention by not being professionally prepared.
Mm-hmm.
He was not professionally prepared. One of the things that Frank Zane won on several shows, Frank Zane came in, he was perfectly tanned from head to toe. You know, Frank Zane was perfectly prepared. When Arnold came on stage, he was always perfectly prepared.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be perfectly prepared. And if you're not, then you don't look. Those lights are harsh.
Yeah.
And they will kill you if you're not perfectly prepared.
But you still gave Danny a 20 in the first round, right?
Yeah, well, you know, because let's face it, first round is symmetry. And that's what you have to remember. First round is symmetry.
Yeah.
And if the guy has perfect symmetry, he's got perfect symmetry.
Right.
Not have perfect muscularity.
Mm-hmm.
If he has perfect symmetry, he's supposed to get a 20 in round one. That's what round one was for. So he's supposed to get a 20 in symmetry.
And then round two, with the muscularity, you gave Roy a 20. Roy and Chris Dickerson.
So Roy had that massive size.
Yeah.
And had that ruggedness. He was cut to shred. He could have been sharper, but he was pretty good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, he's got to get that recognition. He's got to get that recognition.
And then in the third round, the only one you gave a 22 was Chris. You thought he was the best.
In which round?
In the posing round.
Well, come on. Chris Dickerson, I mean, forget
right.
it, you know? But here's the thing. You know what I did not like about Franco?
What?
Can you guess?
His posing?
His posing was okay. Actually, his posing was pretty good.
Okay.
He also did classical music, and
right.
he handled it pretty well. But take a look at the physique.
Oh, the gyno.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I couldn't get past the gyno.
Right.
Like, to me, if you're a judge, you're going to say to the world, this is the best physique
in the world.
And then, boom, you've got a big bitch tit.
Right.
I can't do it.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't do it. Minus the bitch tits, I might have given him first.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was in good condition.
Right.
But that was it. You see, to me, these guys are coming on stage. They're the best bodybuilders in the world. They've got a little money behind them.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing stuff, you've got bitch tits, go see a doctor.
Yeah.
Get it taken care of.
Right.
Don't come on my stage and show this to the world, because that's not a good image that bodybuilding should present to the world.
So when they announced the results at the end, were you surprised at where everybody placed?
Well, you know what? I wasn't surprised, and I'll tell you why. Because as one of the architects of the judging system, and then, of course, that was the last time we used that judging system. From the next year, we went to what we use now, which is called the MUST system.
Okay.
The MUST system is, if we've got 15 bodybuilders on stage, You must place them 1 to 15.
Right.
There's no 2 firsts and 2 seconds and 2/3. You know what I mean?
Right.
You must make a decision who's first, who's second, who's third, all the way down to 15th.
Yeah.
And so that system works best. So that's the elephant in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Judging system that allowed people to get 2 scores of 20 or 2 scores of 19 or 18 or whatever, because yeah. you can't make the decision. And you don't want to make the decision, so you let it come out in the wash.
Right.
So here's the thing. The way I look at it is this. We've got 7 judges, and whatever it comes out, you say, I'm not going to criticize a judge. I'm going to say, that's what we came up with, and that's the result.
Yeah. Were you surprised at the audience's reaction?
Absolutely not.
No?
And that's the job of the audience. The audience is supposed to react the way they see fit. Uh-huh. And if they dislike your result, they dislike your result.
All right. That's it for our first anniversary. So thank you all for listening to the show. And next week, we will have part 2 of our 1-year anniversary of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we will talk about the other seasons we did, including season 4, which was the 1990 Mr. Olympia. That was the only drug-tested Mr. Olympia. And then I'm going to have some clips from season 5, where we talked about the NABBA Mr. Universe and the history of that. And we're also going to have some clips from season 6, where we talked about the Larry Scott years, when Larry Scott won the Mr. Olympia in 1965 and 66. And then I'll also have clips from season 7, which we are into right now. And that's where we're talking about old school bodybuilding. So I hope you guys enjoyed this trip down memory lane. I really liked going back over the clips and listening to some of these old interviews that we did. We had some really, really great interviews over the past year. So join us next week when we will go over part 2 of our 1-year anniversary of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank again our sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We'll see you guys next week. Have a great week, everybody. Take care.